even some countries where the bulk of the population are very poor, you have these enormous structures where everything inside them is an expression of kind of Michael Jackson inconsequential vulgarity and stupidity. Never mind those private equity accounts, and never mind the Learjet, and all of that is destroying the planet as well as destroying your family and your peace of mind.
Assalamu alaikum everyone. With me I have a very special guest today, Sheikh Abdul Hakim Murad, who is the Dean and founder of Cambridge Muslim College, and we're sat in this wonderful building that we've had a tour of. Jazakallah khair, Sheikh, firstly for making the time. Really appreciate it. I know that you've you've got a bit of a cough, a sore throat lingering as well. So appreciate you making the time.
Well, thank you for the opportunity.
Sheikh, I wanted to dive in with this quote that I saw when I came in, and I think it is a good jumping point for the topic that I'd love to explore with you. ليس الغنى عن كثرة الأرض ولكن الغنى غني النفس. I'd love to, get your context to this, but also just generally when people like us at Islamic Finance Guru, we talk a lot about money, wealth, finance from an Islamic lens. How should we as Muslims have, a relationship with money? What should our approach be there?
Well, it takes us back to some of the most sort of elementary sort of first madrasa lessons about wherein constitutes human happiness and fulfillment, not by bread alone, that kind of idea. And the hadith says that that wealth, which really also means independence, a sense of freedom from want, is not from a multitude of possessions, but it's from a liberty or a wealth in the soul. And this is, of course, quite a challenge to certain modern materialist assumptions about what makes human beings happy. But the reality is, if you look at, for instance, the global survey on mental health that recently came out, that was reported in the UK press last week, where they're looking at the percentage of populations in different parts of the world that suffer from anxiety and depression. Generally, there is a positive correlation between GDP and levels of anxiety and depression.
No, interesting.
Which is something that the traditional religious mind would find kind of obvious, but which for the materialists is a bit puzzling and seems to place a big question mark after the whole question of progress. So of the six large civilizational zones that they look at, they find that the highest rate of depression and anxiety is from the English-speaking, the core Anglosphere. So that basically means North America, the UK, Australia, and so forth, where there are rapidly spiraling rates of anxiety, depression, and allied complaints. And the country, and this surprised me, which seems to have the best record of keeping people happy, is actually Venezuela, which is a country that has been through a series of economic crises, of course. But it seems that happiness and median income don't really correlate at all. And that's exactly what this hadith is saying. More stuff won't make you more happy. The process of acquiring it might make you feel more important or that you're keeping up with people, but it's not what this elusive will-o'-the-wisp strange thing called happiness consists in. That comes more from having a strong family life, from having a sense of local community, from having a generally optimistic view of God's purposes towards the world. Mental health in the Arab world was also very good, but took a nosedive after the failure of the Arab Spring, and people at the moment feeling rather pressed and unhappy. So that's the region of the world after the Anglosphere that has the second highest level of anxiety and depression. So there is no correlation at all between having stuff, having the new car, the Tesla, whatever, and actually being a happy human being.
The opposite, possibly, as you say.
Well, it often works out that way. Very often it's the oligarchs who have the most counselling sessions and the weirdest families and issues at that kind of level of sort of mega rich, ultra rich, is a kind of well known. It's a very dysfunctional world, just as Hollywood is a dysfunctional world, just as Wall Street is a very dysfunctional world, humanly speaking. And there's also, of course, the factor of what they call hedonic adaptation, which is a fancy way of saying that basically human beings will find their own level of happiness even if they have recently been subjected to some disastrous bereavement. Oh, or so within a year, I think this was maybe a Harvard or a Boston University survey, happiness levels of people who have won the lottery and those who have had multiple amputations, after 12 months, they're more or less the same. So all of this, of course, is a big challenge to the materialistic dream that there is such a thing as progress, that we're getting more comfortable, that we're getting happier, that in the upper Paleolithic, people were really miserable and anxious and depressed. But in fact, the reality is likely to be that the nearer we are to living in the kind of ecosystem and social environment that's normal to us as a species, the more likely we are to be well-adjusted and happy. In that sense. So I think that's what this hadith is getting at, that human beings, what they are, al-hakum mutakathir, the Quran says, rivalry in worldly increase has distracted you. We're so focused on the extra million that kind of we forget important things. Which is in the hadith. If a man had a valley full of gold, he'd want to have a second valley full of gold. But at the end, la yamla'u fahu illa turab, only dust will fill his mouth. But human beings have been going for tens of thousands of years. We haven't really got this one right. But alhamdulillah, if you're in a solid religious or spiritual tradition, you'll know that even if it's your responsibility to earn a living and to put your kids through the right kind of schools and so forth, that's not really what's going to make you happy or at ease or keep you free of these sort of pandemic-scaled modern mental health conditions. That's going to come from faith, from optimism, from family, from connection to nature, connection to beauty, and through being a kind of normal, primordial, fitri human being, if you like. It's got nothing to do with what's in your bank account.
Makes perfect sense. I think there's an Imam Shafi'i poem as well, similar to that. وَكَذَا الْغَنِيُّهُ وَالْغَنِيُّ بِحَالِهِ لَيْسَ الْغَنِيُّ بِمُلْكِهِ وَبِمَالِهِ
Yep.
I think there's a lot of literature around this, same point.
Yes, I mean, I once arrived at Heathrow with a Mauritanian scholar who'd never been to the West before. And when we were at the airport and we took public transport, I was feeling cheap. he asked me, has there been some catastrophe, some karitha? Because everybody in the tube was looking kind of worried and unhappy. They all looked kind of... Yeah. As if an imminent asteroid impact was threatening the planet. They look really worried. In his village in Mauritania, where people don't have anything, they have to walk a mile for water, everybody's kind of smiling and the women are laughing and it's cheerful. and this, of course, is very subversive realization, although it's kind of obvious, you travel a bit and you see it, to the whole idea that there must be growth and there must be progress and we must get richer and we must buy more stuff and consume more stuff and throw away more stuff. It's the precise opposite of both the socialist and the capitalist model, which all assume that human beings are greedy and will be happy when their greed is satisfied.
So Sheikh, what should me, Ibrahim, or Kabir, or whoever, how should we think about our relationship to wealth? Let's say when we're earning money, as we're working in a career, we're thinking about once we've made the money, spending it, how should we see it? Like, how should we, think about that money?
Well, money is held on trust. We don't own anything. Everything is on loan. And we have to pay the interest on that loan in the form of zakat and other positive things that we can do to express our gratitude to the source of that wealth. The responsibility of the believer, really, first of all, is because we're not a monastic head for the hills kind of tradition. We believe in family life, operating in society, having a job. This is important. That once we have satisfied our legitimate, hopefully modest, realistic aspirations, keeping our family out of the rain, putting kids through reasonable schools, not living in a district where people are dealing in methamphetamine on every street corner, that kind of thing. That is a basic haq that human beings have. Then the rest is fi sabilillah. Otherwise, it's going to be a kind of burden. not just in the next world, but also in this world, because there's a sense in which money sitting idle kind of rots and corrodes and makes us feel sick. If you've got a billion in your sort of private investment equity fund in the Cayman Islands or something, it will have an effect on your soul. Because on some human level, you'll know that there's also a hospital in Tahiti that's got no oxygen. And unless people are complete robots and insensible, they'll on some level experience that. So, yeah, the way of the Sahaba, the way of the Holy Prophet, alayhi salatu wasalam, was la yabitu fi baytihi dinarun wala dirham. No gold or silver coin would spend the night with him in his house. And at the end of the day, if it was there, he'd go out and give it away. Khawaja Nizamuddin Awliya, one of the great Muslim figures of pre-modern India, would have a kind of spring clean of his house every Friday morning, and he wouldn't go to his Jummah prayer unless anything that he didn't really need, money, whatever, had been given out. So we can't attain to those levels, but they are at least a kind of reproach and a stimulant to us, as well as a reminder of the absurdity of the modern obsession with al-hakum al-takathur, growth, progress, yeah, indefinite consumption, with, of course, the environmental consequences that we're now facing from this culture of mass, stupid consumption that it seems just makes us miserable.
Yeah,
certainly makes the planet miserable.
Certainly does. Sheikh, let me, you know, to counterpoint that, I'd love to get your perspective on, you know, someone might say that, look at the some of the Ashra Mubashara, who were very wealthy, Abdurrahman, Uthman, Zubair, he died with huge amounts of wealth. You've got the ahadith that, we've got the Quran, the verses of the Quran that talk about قُلْ مَنْ حَرَّمَ زِينَةَ اللَّهِ الَّذِي أَخْرَجُ لِعِبَادِهِ طَيِّبَاتِ مِنَ الرِّزْقِ. Some of the scholars or some of the Sahaba, like Imam Malik, for example, or Imam Hanifa, you know, went in one direction. How do we kind of balance the two things?
Well, it depends on the individual. In most cases, one can see that the wealthier people become, the less pleasant they become and the more hard their hearts. And it's something that one experiences oneself. Yeah. When one is financially comfortable, one is somehow a bit harder and thicker, and the arteries of the soul are a little bit congested. Then when one is kind of in a sense of real neediness and uncertainty about one's financial future. There are some exceptions, of course, and particularly in the earliest generations of Islam, when people had this tremendous kind of internal vaccination against worldly temptations. So one can see that the early Muslims were often such an exalted spiritual state that the existence of gold and the existence of sand were kind of equal to them. They didn't really affect them, didn't affect their ibadah, didn't affect their compassion to others. Nowadays, we're not quite like that, unfortunately. And also the extraordinary profusion of wealth in privileged parts of the world is of an order of magnitude thousands of times greater than anything that might have been considered wealth in the 7th century, where you have people who are billionaires, multi-billionaires, with the capacity for distraction and enjoyment that exists nowadays that were simply not the case back then. Nowadays you have your private yacht and it has to be 70 meters and it has to have a cinema in it and it has to have two pools and a masseur, and that's what they do in that world. That wasn't really quite what you would have if you had a mansion in Baghdad as one of the sort of 1% in the time of Harun al-Rashid. And probably then also you would be spending on art and culture, which generally the mega rich nowadays tend not to do. The great works of Islamic civilization were produced through sponsorship and patronage of wealthy people, aristocrats, high-ranking court officials and so forth. And as a result, you know, the world is adorned by the great products of Islamic civilization. And so the wealthy who spend on art and high-level cultural literary productions are people who keep the civilization going. Nowadays, it's not quite so clear that certainly our oligarchs in the Muslim world, if you go to their homes, they're often sort of extreme articulations of the worst kind of vulgarity. They've not got a clue. They just cover everything with gold and jewels and bling, and the idea of having a culture or civilization is completely foreign to them. And if you confront them with a beautiful work of art, they they find it quite disturbing. Beauty is always disturbing because it's an expression of truth, and they find that uncomfortable. So they're self-surrounding with extraordinarily expensive forms of uglification is one way that they find of avoiding the disturbing presence of beauty and truth. And sometimes, you know, their palaces are truly colossal. Though in some of the Muslim countries, even some countries where the bulk of the population are very poor, you have these enormous structures where everything inside them is an expression of kind of Michael Jackson inconsequential vulgarity and stupidity. And no craftsman and no guild and no street of leather workers or calligraphers in Baghdad has been enriched by that wealth, but just some imbecile in Hong Kong who churns out ugliness for the mega rich has been enriched. So it's very different to what happened in the pre-modern time when the wealthy were patrons of great art and literature. It's not the case any longer.
And Sheikh, there's this underlying thread to what you're saying, which I want to pick on, which is, that over time, human civilization has progressed, like the corpus of knowledge, arguably, at least in a certain kind, has increased. And I feel like we've compounded on that. So like, you know, the wealthy of today wants to have a yacht with all of its sophistication.
Yep.
They don't just want a simple, house with a pool or something. And my question is that, if that is too extreme, this compounding has led to this kind of extreme, manifestation of wealth. Are you saying that there's a point of human progress where we kind of say that's, we should stop there? Or like, how do you navigate that? Do you see what I'm trying to...
Well, I saw one survey that said, on average, if people have more than $1 million, the more they get, the more mental health complexities they experience. So $1 million, for a lot of people, that's already a pretty comfortable lifestyle. But beyond that, it just adds to your strangeness, your alienation, your sense of paranoia. Probably I would suggest that for most believing people, the level is a lot lower than that. Because if you study with traditional scholars, they don't really care particularly about where they're living or how they're living, as long as there's enough for their families. It's not really something they ever think about or discuss. And sometimes they can live in conditions of what we would consider to be kind of extreme poverty, but they don't experience it as that because they're more interested in what's in the book or who's visiting, and they don't really care about the lampshades or the car outside.
Yeah.
It's not something they ever think about.
And Sheikh, what would you, how would you think about the metric or the thing that we're trying to maximize for? And it might even be that you say, Ibrahim, actually, this kind of maximization, frame is even wrong. Because obviously, I think the capitalist world often will maximize wealth, or it will maximize pleasure. How should we think about it?
I don't think it maximizes pleasure. I think it maximizes forms of entertainment and amusement. Pleasure is something a little bit deeper than just sort of making the relevant pleasure circles of the brain tingle for a while. It's not really what human beings crave. Human beings ultimately are hunter-gatherers designed for semi-nomadic conditions in the upper Paleolithic, and that's what our system, including our mental circuits, are designed for. The more we move away from that, the higher the risk of some kind of internal dysfunction is likely to be. So the beauty of the religion of the fitra is that it takes us back to some very archaic forms. It takes us back to a lunar calendar. It takes us back to forms of worship that are determined by the movements of the solar system. It takes us back to very ancient, very simple forms of fasting, the recognition of sacred places, of sacred times. It's the last of the major religions, but it's the one that most explicitly takes us back to a world in which the natural world is still enchanted, which is why Islam is really the best position in which to situate yourself if you're an eco-warrior of some kind, and where you really have to see yourself as an adversary. Now, the whole Western intellectual Muslim tradition is basically skeptical about the claims of modernity, from Ivan Agueli to Knud Bernström to Henry Behmann, Lex Hickson. They're all kind of saying the modern world is a kind of Dionysian frenzy of meaninglessness that's destroying not just the planet, but ourselves and our own families, relationships, neighborhoods, culture, mental equilibrium. It's a catastrophe. We don't see that it's a catastrophe because we've kind of lost sight of what human normalcy is.
Yeah.
But yeah, if there's anything that unites Western Muslim thinkers, it's that Islam is an alternative to modernity that isn't a a militant or a shouty alternative, but a therapeutic alternative that says, never mind those private equity accounts and never mind the Learjet, and all of that is destroying the planet as well as destroying your family and your peace of mind.
Yeah.
Go back to nature, which is a major theme of the Quran, which is generally not there in the other major scriptures. Engage with virgin nature, engage with family, children. There's so much about conception, embryology, childbirth, family life, respect for parents in the Quran. This is a fundamental source of human happiness and well-being. Go for those archaic, normal human things, but don't mess around in the metaverse or some other thing that some corporation is telling you is cool, because you won't get peace of mind out of that.
Yeah. And so, Sheikh, the question then is, do we, because you said right at the top, we're not a monastic religion, we're not a monastic tradition, but at the same time, one could say, look, what mm-hmm. you're saying, Sheikh, is we shouldn't play the game,
mm-hmm.
You know, politics or finance, and you know the whole setup that we've got today, where you know money is this kind of you know figment of people's imagination that is you know given the power, given value because of mm-hmm. you know whatever the state says. So we're kind of on the chessboard of mm-hmm. I guess modernity. At a certain level we need to play the game. And so how do we navigate what level we go to?
Well, that will depend on individual circumstances. Very often people have to take jobs of a particular kind and live in places where their work takes them. Islam is realistic and not absolute utopian in these things. Ideally, if offered a choice between two forms of employment, you should be able to see which of them is less spiritually destructive and less environmentally destructive. And you should choose that, even if it means a pay cut, because you'll just be happier that way. And you'll also be pushing back against the kind of juggernaut that is entropically running downhill towards some kind of global calamity that is starting to look more and more actual. Not just climate collapse, but nanotechnology, artificial intelligence, many other scientific innovations to do with genetic manipulation that are increasingly becoming threatening to human beings. Modernity is a threatening thing rather than a healing thing. 100 years ago, it might have looked different. Now we have a range of new, enormously well understood and powerful technologies, any of which could eliminate the species. And it's very interesting to see that the serious philosophers the last 20 or 30 years have moved away from the old idea of progress and we're getting better and the future will be better, to how do we put the brakes on and how do we protect ourselves from these existential risks?
Before it's too late.
Before it will be too late. So, for instance, Martin Rees, who's the professor of mathematics at the University of Cambridge, has a book called Our Final Century. He thinks each chapter is about one of these new technologies, and he thinks the chances are that one of them will wipe out the human race within the next 100 years. So we have a Centre for the Study of Existential Risks, so everybody is anxious. Stephen Hawking here in Cambridge said, stop AI research right away because of the so-called Terminator scenario. It's looking more and more as if our cleverness is outstripping our wisdom in ways that eventually may destroy us. It's one of the theories for why there is no intelligent life in outer space, even though they've been looking at it for so long. The theory is that civilizations reach a point at which their technical cleverness enables them to destroy themselves.
Ah, interesting.
And therefore, there are no really advanced civilizations out there because they've had their nuclear holocaust or their Grey Goose scenario or whatever it might be. And it's just a matter of time before secular humanity reaches the same point.
Unless we heed the warning. Unless yes. you've got a system that has a kind of automatic, you know.
Yes, but the problem is, this claims to be the age of reason. This is what we were told after the Enlightenment. Religion, superstition, tradition, irrational. We're going to go with ratio, with reason. But the way we're living today, our economic system, our technologies, they're very irrational because at the moment, we are not heading for carbon net zero. In fact, we're heading almost certainly for a global climate catastrophe. But still, the politicians won't do anything about this because they won't get re-elected. So this isn't actually a civilization based on reason, because what is more unreasonable than pursuing policies that you know are going to cause a global meltdown? But it's what they're doing.
Absolutely. So, Shafiq, on this, from a VC perspective, like a venture capital perspective, I feel like, you know, trying to achieve carbon net zero, the only two places where this could be achieved is not politicians, is, you know, cutting edge science, and then also, you know, crazy venture capitalists who would put the money there to be able to achieve that. So I feel like if we use finance and business for good, it can actually, you know, really help the world.
Yes, but I don't see that is at the moment in any danger of happening on the required scale. Instead, Mr. Musk and others are investing in enormously climate-destroying rockets because he thinks we can go and live in Mars because this planet is finished. That's the kind of level of discourse that it's at. In other words, you abandon this planet to go and live on another planet that's already been destroyed by climate change. That's his dream.
Yeah.
But at the moment, I don't see that there are technologies swimming into the practical life any time in our lifetimes, even panaceas like nuclear fusion and so forth, that really are going to come on stream before the real catastrophes begin. And remember, the countries that are most vulnerable are usually Muslim countries. The melting of the Himalayan ice cap is already starting to produce uncontrollable floods in Pakistan and Bangladesh, and it'll only get worse. The Middle East is the region of the world most threatened by climate change. So the West, you know, in Cambridge, 30 years, I'll be able to grow oranges in my garden, be quite nice. But by that time, 90% of the agriculture of Algeria will have gone. So you're talking about massive population movements, climate change refugees, a situation that may well make the global setup as it exists today completely unsustainable.
So Sheikh, what about, I mean, this is a hard left turn from where we're going, but what role do you think Islam has to present as an alternative? And, you know, thinking about, in particular, you know, structures of power, finance, you know, you've been left in charge, Sheikh Abdul Hakim Murad, how do we change things around?
Well, there would be a lot of technologies that would simply have to be curtailed or stopped altogether, particularly those that are presenting a real existential threat to all of humanity. There would have to be very swingeing penalties placed on hydrocarbon production and consumption. There would have to be massive subsidies for renewables until it would be crazy to use anything else. That's as the technologies for sustainable technologies improve, becoming more and more feasible. There would have to be, ultimately, I think, a sea change in our deep philosophical understanding of what human beings are for. There's no point in telling people to follow the path of zuhud, renunciation, and telling them that over $1 billion they'll get less happy until they have some alternative horizon. Human beings, for 99% of their history, have focused on the transcendent, on the sacred. The earliest human artifacts indicate that there were religious beliefs back then and belief in life after death, grave goods and so forth. That's normal to us. It's part of normal brain function. We're so far from that now that we don't know how sustainable our current levels of cognition might be. We're probably just at the beginning of the mental health pandemic that we're seeing now, and also the social breakdown that comes from intense individualism. We're now the first country in the world to have a ministry of loneliness. They only do that because it's a real pandemic.
Mm.
Over 9 million people in this country have medically significant levels of loneliness. This is not what the Enlightenment promised, but if you unleash the principle of individualism and say no to tradition, collectivity, parishes, family, extended families, and the individual is the measure of all things, I feel like this, I want to be that, I want to self-identify as the other, then you're going to have an atomized society of individuals who are increasingly disconnected from each other, which is what we're seeing, which adds to the spiral of mental health issues with a quarter of the US population now on antidepressants and the number rising constantly. It's not what the Enlightenment thought. They thought getting rid of religion would unleash new horizons for human happiness and functionality, but it's not looking like that at all.
And what would you do to the banks? What would you do to the existing, you know, people who are, you know, in charge?
Collective repentance, Tauba, sackcloth and ashes. Tell them to walk barefoot to Canterbury or to Benares or wherever it is that they claim to have their spiritual home, flogging themselves. They've got the world's money, yeah, and the world is in a mess, so put two and two together. Not a good system. And of course, the ridiculous parasitical creation of capital on capital on capital and loans on cash that hasn't been created yet, and those strange kind of future derivative worlds, that is obviously completely ruled out by any realistic understanding of Sharia, and that is precisely the kind of growth, yarbu, riba, of money out of nothing, which everybody has condemned, from sort of Aristotle to Aquinas to the Quran. Riba is forbidden, and we can see why nowadays. Not just the instability of the financial markets, but the indebtedness of the population, the increasing disparity between rich and poor. However you define the current financial system, it's not performing well on any level, except for a few bankers who have their Manhattan penthouses and indifference to the down and outs on the street below. But no ethical system could possibly endorse it. And there's no sign that within its own logic, there are mechanisms that are self-corrective. It just feeds on its own dysfunction.
And so to challenge that, Sheikh, do we, you know, so there's Islamic banks, and, you know, they go down a certain analysis on how they're going to deal with that. Or is it that, you know, so I'd love to get your perspective on that. Or is it that we just don't play the game and we just take the political route, or that there's like an alternative route to try and change things around?
Well, one has to operate on within the horizons that are available to one. The Islamic banks are better than not having Islamic banks, I would say, even though some of their financial products look to me rather like kind of smoke and mirrors. They come up with some nice sounding Arabic word for something that was originally hatched in the brain of some half-demented kid in Manhattan 20 years ago. I don't see that as being very spiritual. But insofar as, at least ostensibly, they're not investing in immediately destructive or haram products. No, they're not supporting Wall's sausages, for instance, or Diageo or something like that. Better than nothing. Some of them invest in arms, some of them invest in petrochemicals and other things that obviously are exacerbating the global crisis, because those sort of naughty areas of the economy tend to generate considerable revenues. I think an ideal model for Islamic investors has to be that they need to be very aware of where their money is being invested, and that if everything goes into British American tobacco or into British aerospace to make more missiles for some Gulf ruler, that this isn't really the kind of humane or the prophetic ideal.
You wouldn't believe.
I prefer people to invest themselves and take the personal responsibility for the moral and spiritual consequences of what their money is working to do, rather than trusting to someone or other who just wants to make his fund look more attractive than the fund next door.
And you wouldn't believe, Sheikh, that so many of the people who marched, you know, in the war against the war in Iraq,
yep,
in 2003, many of them would have been investors in the same companies that ultimately, you know, profited from the war. And I was talking to a gentleman who was au fait with the Saudi pension fund. And these are people that are managing the money of all the Saudi community, you know, population. And that fund is not, you know, managed in a Sharia compliant way. It's investing in everything. I found it, you know, it just seems like a...
You do have choices. If you click through the University of Cambridge's pension scheme, you can click Sharia compliant or ethical portfolios. Somebody or other is deciding on how to define that, but at least it shows that in the West you have that option, and people are increasingly regarding it as, you know, structurally workable, as well as something that people are looking for.
Yeah.
In the hydrocarbon-rich Muslim countries, because their economies are so undiversified, very often it's kind of futile to tell them stop pumping oil or stop pumping gas, because that's all they've got. But in the longer term, one would wish them to diversify and start generating solar power or something, which they're starting to do, but they're a little bit slow. But of course, those resources are finite, whereas renewables by definition are not. So in the longer term, I think they're going to see the wisdom of that transition.
So Sheikh, I wanted to ask you about the future.
Mm-hmm.
As Muslims in the UK, I think you wrote a book recently, a collection of essays around the the Muslim community in the UK, and how it's very, you know, paraphrasing, you know, there's a lot of cultural baggage that isn't really from Islam.
Mm-hmm.
How do we, you know, extricate, should we extricate that from, you know, from Islam?
Well, you can't tell people to jump out of their own skins and adopt another culture, because that's like telling them not to be themselves. But with the newer generation, inevitably, the older generation having chosen to chuck their kids into the melting pot, to finding the new generation is more responsive to sensibilities and priorities of the ambient society, for better or for worse, and is less doggedly attached to ancestral traditions. So with the younger generation, one can work, certainly. But if you're interested in the long-term sustainability of a religion, then you have to look, say, at, you know, what the Jewish community has done in America and the UK, which is that when many of them came in the 19th century, if you didn't speak Yiddish, you could be excluded from a congregation for being a dreadful assimilationist. Now, none of the synagogues speak Yiddish, as far as I know. I mean, there's a few, but the last Yiddish newspaper in New York, I think, closed recently. But they've maintained their communal identity, and in many cases their religious identity, by making the leap to a British Jewish identity, an American Jewish identity, in ways that were quite carefully worked out, so as to enable them to remain religiously authentic while shedding the baggage of the East European shtetl or whatever world it was that they came from. That process is already unfolding for British Muslims, but there's a lot of people who are torn between different worlds and code switch. So the way they behave at home with their Bangladeshi parents is quite different from the way they behave with colleagues at work. Or it's not necessarily a bad thing, but it's not ideal, because it produces a rather complex identity whose drawbacks can then become clear when they're in long-term relationships or dealing with their own children. It's best to have an integrated single personality. And it's also, of course, a da'wah obstacle. Muslim community is growing through conversion. We haven't seen the most recent census data crunched for race and religion correlation. They haven't quite done that yet. But the last time they did it, 2011, there were about 100,000 converts to Islam in England. And the number is likely to be more now. But to the extent that the mosques are embedded in somebody else's picturesque culture, it's going to be harder for people to convert to Islam. Because taking on the basic obligations of Islam, praying five times a day in Ramadan, that's already a lot for people to carry. To say, oh, you have to join this culture as well. Or you have to go to a place of worship where everybody is doing something from Kurdistan or whatever, and that's what they're about, is an added set of burdens, which is too much to ask people to do that. So I think as the indigenization proceeds, as it always does with minorities, you're going to see more intermarriage, more conversion, the development of an increasingly strong and united Muslim community. To the extent that we're divided into different ethnicities, and in some European countries this is really bad. In Germany, the Turks have their own universe and the Moroccans have their own universe. They don't talk much to each other. In Sweden, the Kurdish communities don't talk much to the Albanians and the Iranians. To the extent that the newer generation is less interested in that, intermarries more, socializes more, you're going to see the development of local Muslim identities that won't really be controlled by anybody, least of all academics like me, but will develop organically as human societies do and will be recognisably local, but also universally Islamic. The mosques are not yet there because the mosques are mostly controlled by the older generation who are clinging on to the ways of back home for dear life. but they won't be with us forever. And whoever takes over is likely, I think, to be more open, more inclusive, more happy to have different ethnicities, even women in the mosque.
God forbid.
Yeah, so things are moving in the right direction, I would say. But religious communities being what they are, it's a glacially slow process much of the time.
It is, it is. Sheikh, so the, you mentioned the Jewish community. I think that they had it arguably slightly easier in the sense that they were, I mean, I'm sure there's like differences within, you know, the different pockets that came to the UK, but broadly speaking, they spoke a similarish language, similarish culture, and they had roughly the same colour of skin. And here you've got, you know, people from Somalia, Pakistan, Bangladesh, all kind of in one melting pot, and projecting forward. I'm just thinking, will it be as easy for them to, you know, because for the Somali that is now the second or third generation kid, he looks around at other Somalis and he's got similar experience to them, which is slightly different to the second or third generation Bengali kid. And so...
Yes, but it's less difference than the difference that separates their parents. That's
true.
The point.
True.
But whether it's harder for us than it was for, say, Jewish people in the Victorian time... I don't know. It may well be that traditional Western anti-Semitism was a more vehement and more religiously active thing than modern race or religious prejudices against Muslim minorities. I don't really know, but I don't think it was easy for them at all.
And do you think we should actively be looking to shed, you know, historic culture?
Well. Again, I don't think it's something you can impose or ideologize about. It's something that happens anyway. If you go to, say, Medina, as I did last year, you can always recognize the British kids on the street. They're larking around, they're talking, behaving in a particular way. It's quite unlike people from the same ethnicity who've come on their Umrah from Islamabad or Dhaka or somewhere. You can see that they're British kids, really. That's not because anybody in the Muslim community said, no, you're going to be British and this is British Islam. Still less is it a kind of Whitehall decision. It's what happens. And religions being universal things should remain when all of the kind of picturesque surface of a culture vanishes. But there are, I mean, again, it's ideological and people will do what they're able to do. One would like to see, and one of the things we do here, is to try and alert them to the greatness of their ancestral culture, an aspect thereof that even their parents may not know about. So if you go to some of the great London museums, for instance, like the British museum with the Bukhari Gallery. When I went there last, it was full of people. It's all Islamic art. And you've got the Chinese tourists, the Japanese tourists, the Europeans, the Germans, they're all kind of looking at this amazing stuff. You don't see the British Muslims.
Mm.
Not many.
Yeah.
It's our heritage, but they don't relate to that stuff. So that's unfortunate. And I think one of the things that can happen with the new generation is that they can be more interested in the great products of their culture even than their parents were. Their parents may come from some folkloric community in Mirpur or wherever where they never really had a high culture, but now we can introduce them to these amazing things. Mughal textiles, and you know, if you go to the Victoria and Albert Museum, the most beautiful stuff they've got there is from Muslim India. But it's not the young British Asians who are looking at it by and large. It's everybody else
Who
are kind of blown away by the amazingness of it. But Muslims they aren't in that space somehow. So that is certainly something that can invite them to take pride in.
Yeah. And so this brings me nicely to CMC, right? Mm-hmm. And the role of education in this bridge, because it's a very fine line, isn't it, Sheikh, mm-hmm. where you can assimilate slowly, which is happening, which mm-hmm. will happen, but it can go down a certain line where you just mm-hmm. lose faith as well, right? So I'd love to get your sense on what education and educational establishments, what role they play and should be playing in this transition phase.
Well, Cambridge Muslim College is quite a kind of thoroughbred institution in that it chooses just a small number of very promising, bright, young British Muslims and trains them quite intensively in the hope that some of them will go on to become community leaders and change the discourse about Islam in Britain. Although we're not at all prescriptive about what that might turn out to look like, but we do want them to be well-educated, because Islam is a religion of knowledge, and to know their theology, to know the Qur'an, Hadith, and the traditional ways the community has developed of understanding those things, so that when they, inshallah, end up as university professors or Muslim chaplains in the RAF or whatever it is they're going to end up doing, they actually know the tradition authentically and profoundly, and are able to give responses to the sometimes perhaps quite startling questions that come to them on the basis of, you know, the authentic ongoing tradition. And alhamdulillah, one of the nice things about working here is that you do see the high levels of enthusiasm and intelligence and willingness to learn amongst a lot of young people. There is a certain amount of fatalism and apathy amongst some young Muslims in Britain who think everything is just overwhelming and they just want to become optometrists in some small town and not think about the clash of civilizations and climate change and the other horrifying thing. It's fair enough. But there are also some who are able to, you know, step up, join the front line and actually try and figure out what exactly are the challenges to religion? What does evolutionary biology really say? What does climate change really mean? What is the singularity? What is the nature of postmodernism? All of the questions that are shaping the way the West is and is dealing with other cultures that most of our ulama really have never even heard of. And that potentially it's dangerous for our community that's becoming increasingly large and increasingly subject to doubts and suspicions, to be led by men, usually as men, who don't really understand the modern world or the kind of things that are being said about them, but just want to retreat into some kind of madrasa utopia and repeat things that were repeated 300 years ago in Saharanpur or wherever. That's potentially dangerous for a religious minority whose identity is still regarded with skepticism by many in the mainstream. We have to have a better leadership than that. And Islam, it's a religion of leadership, it's a religion of kind of being on the front line, trying to change things. It's not really a religion of hiding in a monastery. And alhamdulillah, we find some of the young men and women who train here really are excited by this, you know, historically difficult situation that we find ourselves in the heart of Cambridge, which is like the capital of modernity. It's Darwin, Stephen Hawking, and yeah. Newton. But at the same time, we're trying to do some traditional Islamic thing here, but to see how the two can talk to each other and how Islam as a universal religion, the religion of truth, can develop a successful, intelligent, and not panicky and emotive way of dealing with these very real modern challenges. And a lot of them find it kind of liberative. I think many young Muslims are burdened by a sense that the world is kind of outstripping religion and moving in strange directions, and we're kind of wrong-footed by it, and that can lead to all kinds of internal tensions. If they're trained to understand what these new challenges are and to see that there are Islamic ways of interestingly engaging those challenges, they feel so much better about themselves. You can see the kind of improved morale of the young people once they've really studied the tradition and the modern equivalents, because they feel empowered to be able to talk about those things and understand them, even if there aren't always easy solutions.
And Sheikh, really just to wrap up, the, you know, just picking on that thread of this uncertainty and this, I guess, lack of confidence about, you know, their faith that many Muslims have today. How do we, in a nutshell, you know, I think there's, like, as you said, there's one response, which is retreat within yourself or even flee to, let's say, you know, the Middle East or some other country. Or the other approach is, no, we need to stay here and we need to build here. And I think you're saying very much the latter. How, in order for us to do that, do we make sure that we are as, you know, well protected as we can be to, you know, speak our minds about things as well? Because I find that increasingly, you know, free speech isn't really free for Muslims anymore.
Well, free speech doesn't exist for anybody who wants to step outside the very carefully, even fanatically policed opinion corridor, as they call it, particularly if you work in a public institution like university or Palace of Westminster. You have to at least remain silent when certain things are being discussed, even if those things are, you know, completely against the traditional consensus of all the world's religions. The existence of a diversity of views on those subjects is simply not welcomed in this culture. And as I say in the book, the dominant culture is really delighted to have found certainties again, even though the certainties are generally about the body rather than the spirit or philosophy. They're so excited that they found a kind of aqidah, a creed, that they defend it with a kind of quasi-religious zeal. And anybody who takes a different view from conscientious reasons is a kind of heretic and will be subject to various forms of persecution and marginalization and cancellation. But you know, religion is resilient. We dealt with the Spanish Inquisition and we dealt with all kinds of things in our history. We'll deal with this as well, but in a positive way, by quietly presenting an alternative that actually makes sense to the majority of people who aren't really on board with some of these very extreme social changes that are being mooted by a small number of quite terrifying activists.
Sheikh, I'm sure we could go on, I mean, I personally could go on for hours, but I appreciate that, you know, you've got a sore throat. And I really appreciate all the time that you've made for us. And inshallah, I'm sure we'll be back one day and we can continue this conversation. And hopefully the Muslim community has progressed a little bit by that point.
Oh, it's progressing, certainly. I've been in British Islam for 43 years now. And things are much more exciting, big, diverse, well-resourced than they were back then. There are all kinds of problems that have emerged, but overwhelmingly, I think that the trajectory has been positive.
Barakallahu feek, Sheikh. Jazakallah khair, and assalamu alaikum.
Alaykum salam wa rahmatullah.